You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a UW-Madison professor will be writing a history of U.S. counterterrorism efforts for the Pentagon. We'll ask him how far back that history goes and how to write about a developing topic for a classified audience. Right now, the Kohler Company is best known for its plumbing fixtures, but golf is a major part of their business as well. The company owns four courses in the Kohler area, ranked among the nation's best. They're now working to build another high-end course on the lakeshore near Sheboygan. Proposed 2 years ago, the project has run into opposition from people concerned about its environmental impact, the use of land in a state park, and public access to the Lake Michigan shoreline. Today, the DNR is hosting an open house meeting in Sheboygan, and a rally is being held in opposition to the project. Chuck Kornbach, a WPR reporter based in Milwaukee, he's been following this story, and he joins us now from Sheboygan. Chuck, welcome back.
Thank you. It's a very sunny day here on the UW Sheboygan grounds.
And can you bring us up to speed on the details of this new Kohler Golf project?
Well, again, it would be just, for a while it was going to be just south of the city of Sheboygan in the town of Wilson in Sheboygan County. But earlier this month, the Sheboygan Common Council voted to annex several hundred acres and bring them into the city. So right now it's a city of Sheboygan project, I guess, although there's more debate on that. There might be a lawsuit filed by the town of Wilson, which previously had the property. This, we're talking about just south of the city of Sheboygan and now the city, just north of Kohler Andre State Park. In fact, one of the controversies in why the DNR is here is that the Kohler Company wants to use a few acres of the park to help be part of this golf course project.
Let's talk about that annexation issue first. Had the town of Wilson been opposed to the deal or calling for more requirements on it?
Right. Well, there's been quite an active citizen group in the town of Wilson, especially in other parts of Sheboygan County. For really the last two or three years, this debate has been going on. And yes, the town itself had several concerns or wanted to put too many conditions or too much study into the project. So earlier this year, Kohler came up with the idea and pushed for, let's just not make this the town anymore. Let's make it part of the city of Sheboygan. And the city has been friendlier towards annexing. And there were two or three meetings this summer, and there was some delay in the process. But earlier this month, the city went ahead for annexation again. At the Kohler pressure for it, some are calling it an end run around the town of Wilson.
You said the town of Wilson might be taking legal action. Any timeline on when they might do that?
Well, they are considering it. I would say seriously considering it. In fact, in the annexation vote, Kohler just said it would put up money to help the city of Sheboygan defend any lawsuit. There's been some controversy, some concern by town of Wilson residents, whether there was pressure on some folks in the town of Wilson to ask for annexation, or whether there were truly enough town residents pressuring for this, or whether it was all Kohler Company's activities behind this. So that might get explored in a lawsuit if one is filed.
We're talking to WPR reporter Chuck Kornbach about a controversial golf course proposal in Sheboygan. Let's talk about the pro and con here, Chuck. What are supporters and the Kohler Company saying in support of this golf course?
Well, as you said, Kohler has really branched into the hospitality and entertainment business as well as making toilets and thinks that there is a market for another golf course here. They already have Whistling Straits and Black Wolf Run and others in the Sheboygan area, but they think that on their largely on their property the company already owns, that it wants to turn into a golf course. And there's other people in Sheboygan County saying, you know, the economy's decent, but we think things could be even better. Looking ahead, we think we can get people from Milwaukee, Green Bay, Chicago to come and pay dozens of dollars, $100 or $200, to play at yet another golf course. And so that's the economic development argument. The opponents are saying, we've got some very nice sand dunes on this property. We've got wildlife. This is both deer and other walking wildlife, if you will, and migrating birds that come through here. This is a bad idea, and the town of Wilson people are saying, we've been neighbors of this nice area. Coley used to let us walk on it. Now you're going to have a lot of traffic. You're going to have wetlands disturbed or runoff potentially into the lake, drinking water concerns. And so those are some of the concerns that I think the town residents are bringing to the DNR this afternoon, especially in regards to the Kohler Andre State Park.
Right. Let's talk about Kohler Andre State Park. It borders the land where the course would be built, and some acres of the park itself would be part of the project. Is that right?
Right. The DNR and Kohler has been saying 5 acres for a maintenance building and a driveway sort of thing. But the opponents are saying, well, listen, we've mapped things out. We think it's going to be more like 20 or 25 acres. And significantly, a former Kohler Andre superintendent, Jim Buchholz, has been quite outspoken of late against this project. He says he's walked the land and said this is valuable land that the Kohler Company wants of the state park. And, of course, it would be rather rare in the state of Wisconsin for part of a state park to be sold off or at least used by a private concern. So this is not just an issue here in Sheboygan County, but it's potentially one for state parks or around Wisconsin.
Let's talk about this DNR hearing today. Are they focused mostly on the Kohler Andre issue, or are they looking at wider environmental issues here?
Well, I think, and we should say that it is an open house, meaning the DNR, I was in the building already and has been setting up tables and have staff members on hand. They say they want to hear the citizens identify pertinent issues to be evaluated in the planning amendment process. A couple months ago, the DNR board authorized the process to begin of amending the master plan for the park, and so members of the public are invited to come in and have informal chats with the DNR about mainly the park, I think, but potentially also some other issues just outside the park in the town. And then the DNR is promising there would be a public hearing possibly in November where people could stand up and say, good idea, bad idea, and have dozens or hundreds of people around them listening to this. So, and then there would be another session before the DNR board if the amendments to the state park plan went forward. There would be another opportunity, presumably early next year, for people to testify before the DNR board, probably in Madison.
This process has been going on for a couple of years now. Chuck, what is Kohler's timeline for wanting to have this thing up and running?
Well, I think that keeps getting adjusted somewhat. I think they just are anxious for this to go ahead. Certainly it seems like the CEO of Kohler, Herb Kohler, is very, very determined to see this through. I think the company is willing to wait a bit, but they've also been encouraging the Walker administration to move things along, and the exact when people might be teeing off at this course, if it's built, I think might be 2-3 more years, but they're hoping, Kohler is, to have the regulation process wrapped up by next year. And of course, it's not just the state and DNR. There's going to be some issues for the Army Corps of Engineers, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and perhaps other federal agencies. So it's still got a ways to go, but this is a sort of a significant point to talk about this.
Chuck, thanks a lot for taking the time today.
Thank you.
That's Chuck Krumbach, WPR reporter. He joined us from Sheboygan, where the Kohler Company is proposing a new high-end golf course on near the Lake Michigan shoreline. Coming up, a UW-Madison professor has been tapped to write a history of counterterrorism efforts for the Pentagon. Stay with us here on Central Time. A UW-Madison history professor is off to Washington, his new job writing the ongoing history of counterterrorism for the Office of History for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Hall is a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army Reserve, and he's being placed on active duty to review classified documents and tell the official story of the military's efforts. John Hall joins us now. He's a military history professor at UW-Madison. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob.
Well, describe that new job. We gave some of the basics there, but what are you going to be doing for the Pentagon?
I think I'll be doing few things, actually. In addition to the writing and chronicling the war on terror as it unfolds, which I think had been reported in Madison and a couple of media outlets, I'll be doing other jobs related to historical writing and research in a important office within the joint staff that is responsible for informing senior leaders on the deeper history of a range of issues that are important to national security and international affairs.
I know you can't go into super specifics, obviously, and that's part of the story here. A lot of the work you're doing is going to be classified. What is it going to be like for you to be a historian writing for this, for a fairly limited audience?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the challenges. I mean, of course, historians like to write for a much broader audience. The readership is something that I'll seek and desire, and to be able to write things like this that will never see the light of day outside the Pentagon is certainly different, but there's a compensation involved, I think, and that I know that the people reading what I am writing are potentially making important decisions based upon the products that I'm producing. So it's a smaller audience, but it's not typical for an academic historian to be able to influence potentially policy as immediately as I will be able to do in this position.
Whether we're talking about the military and counterterrorism or about government leadership in general, do you think that we focus enough on the lessons of history as you're trying to get people to do now?
Generally, I think the answer to that question is no, and that's one of the reasons why I'm gratified, and I think that your listeners should be gratified to know that this activity, this office exists, and that there are dedicated civil servants, historians, trained professionals who have the job of looking at a much longer picture with more nuance, more context, and are in a position to lend that historical perspective to these pressing concerns. I spent 15 years, as you said, on active duty in the Army, and it's typical in military organizations, at least in uniform military organizations, to rotate people through jobs every 3 years, sometimes 2 years, sometimes only 1 year. And in that brief amount of time that you're on a job, usually you're getting to a point of a higher level of competence just in time to rotate out to a newer job. And so it's one of the challenges within a bureaucracy such as this or really any other, to provide that longer picture, because there is so much institutional turnover and there's not as much institutional memory as there perhaps ought to be. But this isn't unique to DOD either.
Obviously, terrorism and counterterrorism are not new in 2017 or the 21st century or even to the United States. As you provide that historical context, how wide a net are you casting, both back in time and geographically around the world?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really it's my forte, or it's my responsibility to go back in time and pretty broadly, and that's one of the things that makes this position or this opportunity so interesting, is that I'm getting to delve deeper into issues that are generally outside of my own research trajectory at the University of Wisconsin, and that's definitely exciting to me. But my job is not that of a contemporary intelligence analyst, so I'm really spending as much time really in open source materials, published journal articles, the books on various topics, as I am looking at classified sorts of documents. I look at classified documents primarily to understand problems that decision makers are confronting, so that it makes it easier for me to frame the historical analysis in a way that it's going to be useful. But it's like any other historical research that is synthesized of a wide array of materials.
But that's interesting. I mean, often I think a historian going back and searching through history isn't doing that with that contemporary problem in mind. You kind of tell the story of what happened and don't. This is applied history, I guess, is what I'm saying, which is, I don't know how common that is.
Yeah, it is applied history. I mean, I would say that it's more common in the subfield of military history in which I trained and in which I train graduate students. Military history has always sort of occupied a liminal space or a middle ground between more applied disciplines and the pure domain of academic history. So when I teach and train graduate students at the University of Wisconsin, of course, we're foremost concerned with questions that are historiographically important. And in that regard, it's no different than any other subfield of history. But there's a component of the discipline or of the field of military history that does have an eye toward more contemporary concerns. And so this is not a huge move away for me, because actually my initial training as a military historian was as an active duty Army captain sent to graduate school to get a degree in history so I could go and then teach cadets at West Point. So I am familiar with this form of applied military history. And, you know, that's the difference. What's driving the question? I tell students that a good research project needs to have a question that deserves to be answered. And the difference here is who determines what deserves to be answered and what the motivations for it are.
Talking to John Hall, military history professor at UW-Madison, going to work and writing the ongoing history of counterterrorism for the Pentagon, and look back for lessons from history for modern-day counterterrorism efforts. John, can you talk about the qualifications required for this job? This was not a posting that the general public was going to be able to sign on for.
No, yeah, so I'm fairly fortunate in that regard, is that the pool of qualified candidates was no doubt quite shallow, and I happen to be at the more accessible end of the pool, because I am an Army reservist who's already assigned, or was already assigned, to a joint staff history office. And so until August 18th, my first day on the joint staff, I worked as a historian 2 weeks every summer and periodically throughout the year for U.S. European Command. So in that position, I'm sort of already available as a serving reservist, a PhD in history with a publication record, and notably a top secret security clearance. And I was one of the candidates that, really the first candidate that was recommended to be chief historian of the Joint Staff's History Office, and he didn't need to look any further beyond me.
And you have referred to that comment, that the saying that journalism is the first draft of history, and then historians come in and try to make more sense out of those initial reactions from sometimes the media and the politicians of the day. Well, now, at least in the work you're doing as far as the contemporary history of counterterrorism, you're going to be trying to get a handle on this with that first draft, with what's happening in some cases, I imagine, today. What kind of challenge is that going to be?
Yeah, it's a challenge in a number of regards, because the materials that I'll be working with as a chronicler of these efforts don't enable me to do a great deal of synthesis, right? So, I mean, as I've mentioned, I'm doing more than writing the history of counterterrorism. I'm doing these other research efforts as well that let me reach back into an established body of scholarship on particular topics. And I don't have that here. So what I am doing is, I mean, certainly my training as a historian is invaluable to it, but I'm sort of working in parallel with journalists writing that first draft. Of course, I'm getting to base what I'm writing off of things that the journalists don't get access to, but they're getting to see and interview people that I don't have access to. So I think really, I've mentioned that as a 30-year rolling window. I'm writing right beside journalists who are outside of the building, and together we're writing complementary first drafts of this history that 30 years, maybe not quite that long from now, other historians will come in and be able to synthesize what journalists and historians like me are writing at this moment.
And you mentioned at the outset that historians like to write for as wide an audience as possible. Are you hoping to take what you can from this experience and use it in your own writing down the road?
Yeah, I certainly hope that I'm able to do that, and I'm confident that I will be able to do that. Of course, there have been a number of well-publicized cases recently, most notably involving the Navy SEALs and so forth, who have written blockbuster books without actually vetting what they were writing back to the appropriate authorities. And so anything that I might write down the road on the basis of what I'm learning here, I will be obligated to send back into the Pentagon to make sure that it goes through the appropriate clearance authorities so that I'm not divulging anything. I would think I trust my own judgment pretty well to not put that information in anything I would write for a broader audience to begin with, but I'll have a greater degree of confidence knowing that somebody else is going to take a look at anything I might write down the road on this.
So are you, while you're doing this work for the Pentagon, going to be still attached to UW-Madison?
Oh, yeah. I'm on leave from UW, principally as it pertains to teaching classes in the classroom. Of course, I'm not drawing a paycheck from UW during my absence, but I'm continuing to advise my graduate students. I'll continue to conduct independent study in this day and age. We've got wondrous technologies such as Skype and FaceTime, so I can do that. Distance is no barrier to continuing to be able to serve in those capacities. And I will continue to co-chair with my dear colleague, Mary Louise Lou Roberts, our new Foreign Society and Culture program in the Department of History, which is not yet officially established, but we're very close to that. And I'm also the principal investigator for a collaborative project between the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency and UW, in which we have a postdoc historian in residence within the History Department right now.
And we'll leave it there. A full plate for John Hall, military history professor, UW-Madison, now working with the Pentagon on the history of counterterrorism. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow morning after 8, Joy Cardine and her guests from the left and right take a look at the week in review. They'll weigh in on the latest Democrat to announce a run for governor of Wisconsin, feuding at the top levels of the Republican Party, and more. That's tomorrow after 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, it's been almost 2 weeks since the events in Charlottesville, Virginia, where one person was killed and many more injured during a white supremacist rally. During that time and since, President Trump has taken criticism. People say he hadn't condemned groups like the KKK and neo-Nazis strongly enough or unilaterally enough. Now the United Nations is weighing in. In a recent statement, the UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination said it was, quote, alarmed by recent racist demonstrations. They didn't mention President Trump by name, but they did condemn, quote, the failure at the highest political level to unequivocally reject and condemn the racist violent events. End quote. They're also calling on the U.S. to identify and take concrete measures to address the root causes of the proliferation of such racist manifestations, quoting there again. What might that look like? Will the U.N.'s warning make a difference? Paula Ioannidou joins us now. She's an associate professor of comparative race and ethnicity studies at Ithaca College. She's also the author of the book, The Emotional Politics of Racism, How Feelings Trump Facts in an Era of Colorblindness. Paula, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, first off, what do you see as the significance of the United Nations calling out the United States here?
It's a really important moment because it means that the international community is actually watching what is happening in the United States. And in previous historical eras, the international community has been very important in sort of staging a critique against Jim Crow segregation or other forms of racist violence in the United States, and in some ways has worked to actually, if nothing else, sort of shame the country into examining itself. So this kind of follows that precedent, and it's very important that it has happened, but it also, you know, kind of leaves the question as to how it might actually be implemented.
And how bad do things have to get for the United Nations to issue this kind of rare early warning about the risk of developing racist violence and problems?
I mean, clearly things have gotten extremely bad already. And, you know, the fact that it's 2017 and that Ku Klux Klan and neo-Nazi and white nationalist rallies are taking place seems to a lot of people who only, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, or even if one remembers in 2008 calling the United States post-racial, quote unquote, it seems kind of unbelievable, the kind of resurgence of what has always been there, but we had kind of thought was you know, waning away. So clearly the existence of racism has always been in place in the United States, whether in kind of systematic policies. But I don't think that we have seen this kind of emboldened, explicit bigotry, as well as explicit racist violence of this kind of at this kind of level. And clearly, the fact that the government and people in positions of power like President Trump sort of equivocating neo-Nazis with counter-protesters only emboldens that some more. So you know, it clearly means things have gotten terrible and terribly bad for the UN to actually, you know, want to actually make a statement in an official capacity.
So, yeah, again, the committee saying disturbed by the failure at the highest political level to unequivocally reject and condemn the racist violent events. What would you like to see from political leaders at the highest and lower levels, for that matter?
It's hard to say because so many of the political leaders that surround the president are of a similar mind, you know. So how do you get somebody like Jeff Sessions, who is supposedly supposed to represent the kind of legal arm that would enforce, you know, measures against racial discrimination to enforce those measures when he himself has such a horrible record of, you know, basically endorsing white supremacists as well as very, you know, segregationist policies. So it's hard to imagine that the current, you know, the current, certainly the many of the Republican representatives and those that kind of identify with the alt-right that have sort of moved from the fringes into the centers of power of government, that they would do anything about this. If anything, they may have been more measured in how they would kind of, you know, endorse their racism. They might not be as explicit as the neo-Nazis are, but I'm somewhat hopeless that they would be the people to actually stand against it in any kind of real way, in ways that are actually tangible. So I would look to actually everyday people and you know, to mass mobilizations that have taken a place across the United States that, you know, to condemn this kind of violence and to condemn the resurgence of white nationalism rather than the government right now.
Speaking again to the impact of this UN statement, Sean on Facebook writes, the UN has Saudi Arabia on the Human Rights Council, which has major human rights violations. With that in mind, Saudi Arabia accused of violations against the Shiite minority there, among others. So how much weight does a UN statement like this have when the UN is composed of member states, many of which have very serious problems of their own?
Yeah, I think that there are, you know, several critiques to be made of the United Nations, and specifically whether it has very much leverage against countries like the United States, specifically because the United States, you know, funds a lot of the United Nations, and therefore, you know, sort of, you know, will the United Nations sort of bite the hand that feeds it? So that's one major issue, and certainly the United States has a pretty terrible record on human rights violations itself in many domains, and yet it rarely has been, you know, kind of at the center of scrutiny by the United Nations. So there's some ambivalence there as well, you know. But at the same time, I think you know, it's an important symbolic gesture that the United Nations made this statement, because it sort of represents a kind of watchful eye from a larger international community.
We're looking at a UN committee statement warning of issues of racial animosity, white supremacy in the United States, saying there's a failure of leadership in the United States. Paula Ioannidi is with us from Ithaca College, author of the book The Emotional Politics of Racism, How Feelings Trump Facts in an Era of Color Blindness. And Paula, you were talking earlier about individuals responding to this. And I want to get into some of what you've written about in your book and elsewhere. You write that when it comes to issues of race and racism, our emotions often trump any kind of, and you use the word Trump there, and it was 2015. I don't think that was a pun.
Right.
But the emotions trump the facts and reason when it comes to thinking about race. Spell that out for us.
Yeah, so basically all sociological evidence shows that white men in particular and white people in general continue to be the most privileged members of U.S. society. And by privileged, I just mean, you know, sort of automatic advantages that they receive, either economic advantages, employment advantages, social advantages. So there's a huge body of evidence, that empirical evidence, that shows that they are essentially the beneficiaries of a lot of either past advantages or current advantages. That factual reality, however, doesn't seem to make a difference when white people, and specifically, you know, white extremists or white nationalists, sort of perceive a sense of victimhood, right, as we have seen with these rallies in Charlottesville. What you hear from their narratives is that, and not just from white nationalists, but in general, you know, from other everyday white folks, is that they feel that they are in a state of demise, that they're losing their culture, that their culture is under attack, their heritage is under attack, that affirmative action policies are now disadvantaging them. And so this kind of falsified phrase of reverse racism emerged. So all of that doesn't actually have sociological evidence to back it up. But on the in sort of the economies of feeling that people sort of perceive of themselves and of their own environments, all of this seems to be true. So what I argue in the book is that we can't sort of just discount people's feelings, essentially because these feelings in some ways basically keep people from receiving or being receptive to the sociological evidence of systemic racism, right? They sort of perceive it as not existing, or certainly they will twist the facts and invert realities, you know, from what they actually are. So I tried to think through, what do we do with this problem when people's beliefs and feelings essentially are based on false evidence or no bad evidence, or, you know, as the phrase was, alternative facts, right? And essentially what I propose is that we have to create more cultures where people become more receptive to that evidence, rather than just kind of continuing to assume that if we just present people with the evidence, they will believe it.
Okay, how do you do that?
Well, you create counter-movements, and that's very hard work, but we've already seen some very encouraging signs of this. Certainly, you know, Charlottesville happened, but what also happened, and what wasn't as covered in the media, I don't think, was, you know, hundreds of counter-protests across the nation of people, interracial crowds, saying, we do not stand by this narrative. We stand against this narrative of white nationalism, neo-Nazism, and Ku Klux Klan, and we stand, against white racism. And in those counter-protests, what you have is not just an oppositional force, but a kind of creative force that creates a counter-feeling, something to aspire towards. And so that feeling that is becomes socially shared in those movements essentially wants to align with racial and gender justice and other forms of human rights, and wants to aspire to a different kind of America. So I think we're kind of in that crux right now, where two very different factions of America are kind of struggling for its soul and which direction we're going to go from here.
Paula Ioannidi is with us, Associate Professor of Comparative Race and Ethnicity Studies at Ithaca College. We're talking about a United Nations panel calling out the U.S. over a failure, it says, to adequately confront racist rhetoric and action in the country, and what the government could do to change things. You can call in now at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see from the U.S. government, from the Trump administration on issues of racism, racist rhetoric, neo-Nazi groups? What would that approach look like? And what about everyday people? What role do you think people should play in all of this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Paula Ioannidou is with us. She's an associate professor of comparative race and ethnicity studies at Ithaca College. In a recent statement, the UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination said it was alarmed by recent racist demonstrations in the United States and what they're calling failure at the highest political level to unequivocally reject and condemn racist violent events in Charlottesville. Join in with your thoughts, your reactions at 800-642-1234. Are you alarmed by what you've seen, protests of neo-Nazis and affiliated groups? What, if anything, would you like to see done about it? Who would need to lead that change, if any? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. To the point of President Trump's reaction, Travis on Facebook writes, the president, condemned the action in his first speech, second speech, and third, and at the Afghanistan speech and at the rally. And the president has said this at his rally in Phoenix. Hey, I did condemn bigotry and the hate groups. What do you say to the argument, Paula, that the president has made enough of an effort to condemn the acts in Charlottesville?
I really disagree with that. I mean, I think that any condemnation has been coupled with a kind of equivalence, a moral equivalence between neo-Nazis and white supremacists with counter-protesters. And when you do that kind of moral equivalency, what you're saying is that there's this marketplace of ideas, and all ideas are kind of equally good. In other words, that fascism, you know, is just as good as, you know, racial justice. And I just can't get behind that kind of equivalence. He condemned bigotry, but then he said, you know, everybody was at fault on all sides. Well, the counter-protesters didn't run somebody down with a truck, you know, which was, kind of mimicked acts of terror that we've seen in Europe by terrorist groups. And so, to me, it was done in a kind of I have to do this kind of way because, there's too much public outcry if I don't do it. But in his kind of more candid moments, you could read through that that kind of statement to see what the president really thought about this.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Tim is with us in Delavan. Tim, hi.
Well, this whole subject matter kind of troubles me a bit because, first of all, it's bad behavior on a very minor portion of the population, and we should not be glorifying or magnifying it. I think the media is somewhat complicit in furthering their cause because they give them the spotlight and something to stand on, which is just what they're after. If we ignored these small group protests or the small groups that are trying to create some kind of fervor here, the white supremacists and Nazis and that, they'd probably dry up and blow away. But, you got a professor there that's looked into this. My gut tells me human nature says that that's what would happen, but I wonder if anybody studied that. So it seems counterintuitive what we're doing here.
Tim, thanks a lot for the call. And other people have made this case, Paula, that these are small fringe groups, media coverage of them and maybe even counter protesting them, though that wasn't what Tim was saying, is just giving them more attention, more publicity, fanning the flames, keeping their message alive, and maybe helping them bring on new recruits.
Yes, I think the caller makes a really good point, right? Do we kind of amplify and embolden this type of behavior if we keep talking about it and sort of, you know, reporting on it and focusing on it? But the research shows that although this these types of groups that are very overtly white supremacist and bigoted are relatively small in the United States, that since President Trump's campaign, their proliferation, their activity online, their kind of public presence has actually greatly increased. I encourage people to go to the Southern Poverty Law Center to look at kind of the rise in both hate crimes as well as these kinds of white nationalist groups across the United States. The second thing I would say is that some of them, although they would not be as overtly bigoted as the current rally in Charlottesville was, certainly endorse many of the similar kinds of ideas. And they often wear suits rather than swastikas. And many of them have actually organized in local as well as national contexts specifically against immigration and against kind of undocumented immigrants. And the research shows that everywhere these you know, groups have actually done these local movements, that the rise in anti-immigrant, anti-black, anti-Latino, anti-Muslim in particular violence also rises. So while I understand the point that we shouldn't talk about it, I think that the rise of overt racist violence and the emboldening process of this is actually taking place, despite the fact that those who are kind of, you know, really overt in their views are still a relatively small minority. So what I'm actually, the wider point is that although not everybody is as extremist in their viewpoints, many people still identify with a kind of sense of white victimization and the sense that, you know, there needs to be a kind of resurgence of centering whiteness in American culture.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to Eric on the line in Green Bay. Eric, hi.
Yeah, how are you doing today?
Good. What do you think?
Good. I guess I just had a kind of a two-part, one maybe a statement, the other one a question. One, I guess, addressing your guest on there, which it's nice to have her on there. I guess my first point would be, what would Donald, you know, they want us to do more or think Donald Trump should have done more to kind of, you know, put out the fire of this, the racial tension that's been going on the last 2 weeks. But I guess, one, what would Donald Trump even be able to say that would change anything, especially being such a low approval rating, et cetera? I mean, since when, I guess, has words done anything to, except, you know, help out the divide between races? And my other part of my kind of call is to the point that you're making on the previous caller, I think we're seeing more of this, and this is just my opinion. I think we're seeing more, I guess, neo-Nazis and that type of groups coming out in public, but I think we're seeing everything coming out more in public, everything from, you know, you look on social media.
I got you, Eric. We're just about out of time, so I want to jump in. Paula, could a powerful message from a president, an unequivocal message, as this UN committee was calling for, make a difference?
I think if nothing else, it would make a difference in not emboldening people to keep building this resurgence of white nationalism, if that makes sense. In other words, every time the president and other members of Congress don't condemn this violence and don't actually, you know, follow legal measures to, you know, prosecute people who engage in acts of racist terror, what happens is that becomes a license to keep building this kind of movement. So certainly I agree with the caller that, you know, can words do anything to help? Not often in terms of, you know, systemic implementation, but it certainly is important for a kind of, like I was saying, feelings have a way of becoming contagious. And, you know, neo-fascist feelings can also become more contagious amongst those who actually endorse it if there is a kind of culture of permissibility, specifically from government, where they feel that they will not be condemned, prosecuted, or stopped in doing that.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Paula Ioannidi from Ithaca College, author of The Emotional Politics of Racism, joins us to talk about the United Nations panel calling out the U.S. over what they say is a failure to confront racist rhetoric in the country. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, witness intimidation is a serious issue in Milwaukee courts. We'll talk to the co-author of an in-depth series in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And for Food Friday, we'll learn how to make the ideal sandwich just in time for back-to-school lunches. That and some of the top news of the day coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9, it's the Joy Cardine Show. Tomorrow after 7 each year, Beloit College releases their mindset list for the incoming freshman class. You can find out how the class of 2021 sees the world, what they grew up with, what they didn't grow up with, their pop culture references, and more. And find out how it compares to your mindset and when you were brought up. That's coming up tomorrow after 7. It's always a lot of fun to look at and think about. That's here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a business leader tells us why he joined a coalition to support bringing Foxconn to Wisconsin and giving a big incentive package from the state to help them do that. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to the Ideas Network.